What are the intangible costs of fraud? And is your organization taking relatively simple steps to prevent fraud? I'm Neil Amato, a senior editor with the Journal of Accountancy. In this episode, we'll explore fraud prevention with Danielle Supkis-Cheek, a CPA and the Director of Entrepreneurial Advisory Services at Houston firm PKF Texas. Here's our conversation. Danielle, thanks for being on the podcast.
Of course, happy to be here.
What are some top inexpensive and easy ways to better mitigate fraud for organizations?
So I'd say the top two, just quick and easy, bang for a buck, easy wins. Number one, fraud hotline. The ACFE report to the nations has substantial losses, reduction in the median loss and the duration of fraud losses because of tips. Fraud hotlines can be as cheap as only $250 to $500 for a year. And so just bang for buck, you can't do anything better than a fraud hotline if you have to just spend the minimal amount of money. I'd say number two, a data monitoring program. Proactive data monitoring is up there as well. You're looking at, same again, about half reduction of fraud duration and fraud losses.
You put up a slide in a recent presentation that said only a small percentage of victimized organizations had actually implemented such controls. Why is that?
I would say it's so nebulous. No one really knows exactly what data analytics is. It's, you know, the term in vogue, and it's you know, the visualizations and the big data, and it's a little scary, and you think you have to have somebody that's really specialized and hire one person that's all they do, and they have to have like an MIS degree and all of these, and you need super fancy software. But, you know, Tableau is not that expensive. You're talking somewhere in the like $70 per user per month. A lot of companies already have Power BI. Excel is extremely powerful. You know, of course, we carry some more expensive packages as well for data cleanup, but you don't have to have overly expensive tools to put in some of these data monitoring and data programs. You just have to be thinking through your data. Sometimes you have to spend a lot of effort on the data cleanup and thinking through the data and how does one metric interplay with another metric. And that's what you're trying to think through. And a lot of times people don't know what the trends should or shouldn't be. Sometimes you don't even know yourself what they should be until you see the data. And so we kind of take a scientific methodology approach to it of come up with what we think a trend should be, kind of, you know, so a hypothesis, then find some way to test the hypothesis, and then go back and see, did it meet it? Did we have some outliers? Did we completely mess up the data, you know, manipulation to actually re-aggregate the data to whatever metric we're trying to look at, and trying to put in place things that would actually hopefully detect fraud. And as a side benefit, you also get some operational efficiencies or operational information. So I think people are afraid of it. They're afraid of the unknown. It's, you know, everyone talks about all these cool, new, emerging, crazy technologies, but they don't realize that they can actually still scale down to smaller businesses and that a lot of stuff can be done in-house or relatively cheaply with consultants.
So speaking of something they shouldn't be scared of, let's go back to hotlines. They seem really easy and inexpensive. Why are people not using those more?
I think people just don't know about them as much, or they just, well, we don't need it. We have a good business. We have a good corporate culture. We, you know, nothing's ever going to happen to us. You know, people feel comfortable with coming into my office. We have an open door policy. And while tips do come in through, you know, tips to supervisors, more tips will come in through hotlines. And even if you have to do one of the hotlines that has a pay per minute fee as well as the base fee, you're talking like $1 or $2 per minute type charges. Maybe you're looking at $60 to $100, $120 an hour worth of time for getting specific information about a potential fraud. So even if it ends up not being a fraud and just either a business inefficiency or a, you know, kind of somebody's not quite doing something they should on company time and maybe a time theft thing, or maybe it's not, maybe it's just pushing the limit of inefficiency versus fraud, that's still better than paying for a consultant to come in at, you know, $475 an hour to try to start poking around and figuring out when you have somebody that has specific information that can help your business.
What are some steps organizations can take to have strong employee policies in place that can help reduce fraud?
So I think all the stuff that your HR professionals are usually telling you is usually on point about this. You know, having good corporate governance, having the employee handbook, outlining all the different policies and procedures, some of the policies and procedures that HR may forget about sometimes, stuff like the right to inspect devices that come on site. So if employees are bringing personal devices on site, allowed to inspect that. And if they log into any personal accounts, like a Gmail account on a company computer, that they have rights to the information that's attached to their hardware. Other things about recording audio and video of the employees while they're on site, depending on the state you're in, if you ever need to do an investigation and record information, that may be a relevant policy. It's a state-by-state metric, so always consult your lawyer on these kinds of things. But, you know, a good corporate governance in general will help raise the ethical environment of your organization. Also help people think that you really are paying attention to this kind of stuff, plus getting some of these specific ones in that can help in an investigation process.
Well, we'll go back to the legal representation topic in a little bit, but first, what is a fraud tree and why should finance professionals care about it?
So the ACFE, the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, puts together a fraud classification tree that goes through all the different types of frauds that fraud professionals can think of and see. So there's the standard academic asset misappropriation. So those are your embezzlements and theft of inventory type things, the assets growing legs and walking away. And then financial statement fraud. So that's just manipulating the numbers. They add a third one, which I personally agree with, on corruption as a third type of fraud. And it's a good starting place if you don't know where to design some controls and how to think through what risks we have at a business, literally looking through the fraud classification tree and saying, okay, I don't think we'd ever have a ghost employee situation, but let me think through how I could perpetuate a ghost employee situation at my business and use that. Okay, next one, go through the tree and think through all those different types of frauds.
A topic you mentioned in a recent presentation, uncomfortable conversations. What is their role? What is their importance in fighting fraud?
So it can be tough, as the title suggests, is that a lot of times you need to have some really uncomfortable conversations in order to get either at the root of the issue or help perpetuate a good corporate culture and have a good environment that helps reduce the risk of fraud. So some examples are, if you as a rank and file accounting manager, accounting controller, or CFO have to go talk to a business owner that, you know, the founder of a business, privately held business, this is the bread and butter, and have a conversation about potential fraud risks that could be perpetuated by the business owner against maybe their investors, against himself. I do subscribe to that you can embezzle from yourself. And so trying to find a way to turn those conversations into a positive so that you can actually have those, not being afraid of those. Of course, you have to find a way to be able to communicate with that person without them feeling attacked, because fraud has a very strong connotation. Anytime you use the word fraud, people think you're accusing them of fraud, even if you're trying to protect that person. So turning something like that of having to go talk to a boss about there's a risk of fraud with your control access or your access to this, that, and the other, you know, you can turn it around of, you know, we're worried that if something were to ever happen to you, you're going to, or happen in this scenario or situation, everyone's going to assume it was you because of this, that, and the other access. You would never do that. You're the most perfect person of all time. We need to find a way, and maybe stroke the ego a little bit, but maybe find a way to make sure we protect you so that nothing bad ever happens to you because something bad happened at the company. And so having the wherewithal to think through how to have those difficult conversations and the communication skills, but also having the courage to actually have them.
It does take courage to have those talks. Absolutely. Explain a little about the Hawthorne effect, what that term means and how it can be effective.
So in effect, in short, it ends up being that people change their behavior when they think they're being observed or are being observed. So a lot of times what you can do in a fraud situation, particularly when you don't know what's happening, you know something's wrong, something's amiss, the numbers are starting to look bad because of your data monitoring program and something's going awry, but you don't exactly know what it is, you start tightening the control environment. In actuality or even in perception or both, and see what happens. If the person that's perpetuating or allegedly perpetuating a fraud realizes that the controls are in place that might detect the fraud, they may scale back the fraud, they may stop the fraud, they may put it on pause. You start looking at what's changed. You compare the numbers from before and compare after certain stages. Look at the numbers, see what changes, start your investigation there.
Speaking of investigations, we said we'd go back to the legal representation topic. Why is it important for organizations to seek legal representation before beginning to investigate instances of fraud?
So the lawyer really is the most important person on the team and needs to be the first person on the team. The reason is that you can actually commit crimes while investigating a fraud if you do certain things. It just depends on your state. It depends on your policies and procedures. Even if you don't commit a crime in itself, you might have some elevated risk of doing something wrong that, you know, puts the entity more at risk. So having the lawyer to advise you, as well as having the lawyer that can set up an engagement under privilege. CPAs usually only have confidentiality and except for circumstances such as the work product privilege that comes through from the attorney. So if you have a matter that needs to be reported in a very particular way in the future, particularly to government agencies or other reporting mechanisms, a lot of times you want that under privilege until it is time to report and self-report to get, you know, whatever it is that you need it done. Sometimes you have criminal liability that attaches to business owners and that lawyer needs to be in place. Depending on how you do the investigation, there are things such as Upjohn warnings that you need to make sure the employees that are getting interviewed understand that if there's a lawyer involved, that it's related to the company's privilege and not the that individual employee's attorney, it's the company's attorney. And so all these different things, the attorney can advise and walk you through and then bring in the additional professionals. You know, I'd love to be the first phone call, but the first phone call really needs to be the lawyer. And if we are the first phone call, we make sure we get that lawyer involved.
In some fraud surveys or data breach surveys, it seems they like to put out, you know, the average cost of the fraud was, and it's because it's a dollar figure that people can relate to. But beyond the fraud itself, what are some of the secondary costs of fraud?
So pure out-of-pocket costs, so you not only have the actual fraud, but honestly, the fraud investigation and the pursuit of whatever civil remedies can almost re-victimize a client for how expensive they can be. Sometimes they are in excess of the amount of the actual fraud, and that's why a lot of times you don't see the amount of attention put on some of these smaller frauds because the cost to investigate is so high. Thirdly, you can also have direct out-of-pocket costs. If you're the victim organization that somehow has an obligation to another organization, a good example is a nonprofit that's on cost reimbursement grants, and let's say somebody embezzled from the nonprofit, you put that in on your billing for the cost reimbursement grant, then you've in effect embezzled from whatever government agency you sent that invoice to. So you can actually have fines and fees related and actually have to reimburse money. And fines at the victim level, at the company, and the company actually is perpetuating the fraud, even though they're the victim of the fraud, and so you have those fines and penalties. You also have all the other intangible opportunity costs of people's time that they had to change all this, increased control environment, PR reputational risk. You know, when you investigate the crime, sometimes you have to call some customers and vendors and ask some questions because you don't have the records you need. And so that can start adding really up on, you know, a $250,000 fraud, while horrible and really expensive, can turn into a multi-$1 million fraud.
There may be no way to, quote, put a bow on this, but in closing, is there anything you'd like to say in summary about fraud and preventing it?
Well, it's cheaper to prevent it. So an ounce of prevention is what I like to say. But I would say, you know, looking at the cost that you could be subject to on the back end if there is fraud, as well as just the lost productivity and all the just culture, and especially the private business owners, that this is their entire livelihood tied up in it and everything's on the line for this, and the amount of sleep you lose even, you know, putting in some preventative measures to hopefully prevent it is so much cheaper and honestly will usually give you some operational benefits as well and put you in a good position to really grow the business. We love working with companies that want to spend time on the preventative side, even though we don't nearly make nearly as much money on it, but It's a happier time. You get to do it on your schedule. You get to really put something in place that you can be proud of and, you know, hopefully prevent it. But it's so hard to quantify what is prevention worth. And so I would say that's the way to go at the end is spend some money on prevention. And it's really not that expensive to start up a program in-house.
It seems a lot of people have a story of fraud. They like to tell you after you've done presentations, but is there any story of fraud that you like to tell more than others?
This one's actually a friend of mine's fraud. He didn't commit the fraud. A friend of mine's story that he investigated the fraud. It's one of the best I've heard. Long story short, a bookkeeper was making the tax remittances for the personal taxes of a closely held business that was a pass-through entity. Really long story short, she in effect was putting the money to her account at the IRS, in effect on her social security number, as well as the business owners, and waiting the long game for this one, because you pay in each quarter on your estimated tax payments, and then at the end of the year, she would do her little 1040 with her W-2 and get a giant refund. So you're in effect using the IRS to launder and embezzle your money, which I thought was a pretty brilliant fraud, but that's playing the long game as well as, really hard to catch because the money's going to the IRS and actually made it to the Department of Treasury. So that's probably the favorite I've heard story.
Thank you so much, Danielle.
Of course. Happy to be here.
Again, that was Danielle Supkis-Cheek on ways organizations can prevent fraud. For more podcasts, visit journalofaccountancy.com/podcasts or find us on Podomatic, Apple, Google, or Spotify podcast channels. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.